From NPR and WBUR, I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. Facebook stock opened higher this morning after weeks of controversies shaved nearly $100 billion in market value off the company. The rebound came after CEO Mark Zuckerberg said Facebook has not seen a change in users or advertisers despite more privacy revelations. Yesterday, the company said malicious actors took advantage of search tools, which allowed them to collect personal information on most of Facebook's 2 billion users. Now, that's separate from the news that the political firm Cambridge Analytica gathered data on even more people than originally thought. It's now up to 87 million. Let's bring in Ina Fried, chief technology correspondent for Axios. Hi, Ina.
Hi, Peter.
So let's start by explaining what Facebook said about these malicious actors who've been able to scrape information from almost every one of its users. What do we know about that?
So basically what they've determined is that people were able to do searches in bulk and find – now, this is public information, so anything that on Facebook you've marked as public. So not the stuff you've said, only my friends, but anything that you've marked as public – they were able to get by searching for a user, every user basically, and then downloading that information.
Who was it? And do we know what they might have wanted to do with it?
They didn't say. You know, I think it was probably a lot of people over time. They put in some limits, but people found a way to get around those limits. So they didn't go into who. But, you know, I would just assume anything that you made public, you know, is in the hands of a variety of people.
Yeah, so another blow there for the company. Facebook says it's disabled that search function. Zuckerberg also said Facebook will offer more privacy controls like the ones that will soon be required in Europe. What's that going to look like?
So Europe has a law, and this affects everyone on the internet, going into effect in May, that's called GDPR. And what it's going to let people in Europe do, and Facebook saying they're going to basically make this available globally, is you can see what a service knows about you. You can delete that history. You can download it. So basically, it's making that information available broadly. Whatever a service knows about you, you can see. So that's powerful information to know.
Zuckerberg's going to go before Congress next week. He's going to talk to lawmakers. It's going to make a ton of news. The whole country will probably be watching it in one form or another, probably on Facebook. What do you expect from Mark Zuckerberg when he goes before Congress?
Well, I think we got a preview yesterday. He talked to reporters for about an hour and was pretty candid. I mean, we asked all kinds of questions and he basically answered every one. I think the big difference next week is Congress will be a lot tougher and probably not let him complete his answers. I think you're going to hear a lot of questions about why they didn't do more sooner. I think from Facebook and from Mark Zuckerberg, you're going to hear we should have, you know, in retrospect and, you know, going forward, because that's been their tone in general, is to not defend what they did in the past, but just say they know more now. I think we'll hear that a lot. I think we'll hear that trust is important to them. I think specifics are the key. What are they actually changing is my big question.
Yeah, Zuckerberg was also asked yesterday by reporters whether or not he should stay with the company. What kind of pressure is he facing and how did he respond to that?
I mean, he said that he's the right person for the job. I think he's actually facing very little pressure.
Uh-huh.
He has voting control of the company. I think, truth be told, you know, there probably isn't anyone equipped to run it in the same way that he does. He's the vision. He also took accountability. He said, look, you know, they also asked, you know, has anyone been fired over this? And he's like, no, look, I'm responsible. I'm not going to throw somebody under the bus for what's ultimately my job. So he's not going anywhere, but he's also not blaming anyone else.
It was also a little surprising to hear him say that the company has not seen a meaningful impact on the way that people are using Facebook or the way that advertisers are buying. We had seen at least a social media movement that people were deleting their Facebook accounts, but he's now saying it sounds like that not much of an impact there. I mean, what does that tell you?
I mean, it tells me that people say they're going to do things a lot more than they do. We saw people saying they were going to delete Facebook. That's different than actually doing it.
Yeah.
I think the interesting contrast here is between delete Uber that started, you know, in the wake of actually it was a travel ban thing that initially prompted the first delete Uber, not all the privacy stuff. And, you know, people had a ready alternative in Lyft, so they could delete Uber and use Lyft. With Facebook, there's no comparable alternative. So you're really saying I'm going to not use this broad social media if you decide to do that. And I think most people aren't prepared to do that. I will say the question is, does usage go down? So not do people actually delete their accounts, but do people use the service less? I think that's the real consumer risk here, is not so much that people are going to give up Facebook entirely, but that they're going to share less, spend less time on the service.
All right. Ina Fried, Chief Technology Correspondent for Axios. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Peter.
Palestinians are gearing up for another day of big protests on the Gaza border tomorrow, the border with Israel. Last Friday, tens of thousands of Palestinians protested along the border. Palestinians have been holding smaller protests every day since. At least 19 Palestinians were killed and hundreds injured, according to Palestinian officials. Human rights groups say that Israel used excessive force. Israel says the troops fired at those posing a threat and warns it'll do the same tomorrow. Protests are supposed to last until mid-May, but the Israeli army says it will not allow the protests to continue. Daniel Estrin is in Gaza City right now. Daniel, despite the warning from Israel today, are Palestinians still preparing for protests tomorrow?
They are, Lisa. They're stockpiling old tires to burn at the border, collecting tires at intersections for trucks to come pick up and drive to the border. And they're going to burn those tires to try to create a smoke screen to make it hard for soldiers on the other side of the border to see what's going on. Now, I just want to give you a picture of what this whole area looks like. There's flat farmland. There's a fortified border fence on the Israeli side. Soldiers have set up dirt mounds. Sometimes you can see soldiers coming up from behind them. And then on the other side of the border fence, there's an area about 400 or 500 meters long on the Gaza side where protesters are gathering. There are some ambulances there too. There's a sand barrier, a kind of berm that's been set up. And then behind that are tents and food trucks and this kind of festival atmosphere. Now, also today, a Palestinian militant was killed in an Israeli airstrike. A militant group claimed him as one of its own. Another man died of his wounds sustained during Friday's violence. And another interesting thing that's happening today is that Hamas, the militant group that is controlling Gaza, Hamas is paying $200 vouchers to people who were wounded on the border. We went to a bank today. We saw young men on crutches holding these colorful vouchers branded with the Hamas logo and cashing them in. Now, Hamas describes this as a way to compensate, you know, people for their commitment to the Palestinian cause. I spoke to some people at the bank and I said, will this encourage more people to go protest tomorrow? One person said, yes, I think it will. Another man said, no, it won't. So people here have a very bad financial situation. There's high unemployment and people really need the money.
That's, that situation is hard to decipher. We know that these protests, these sit-ins have been billed as nonviolent. Who's responsible for them turning violent?
Right. Well, it depends on who you ask. I mean, the Israeli army says that Hamas is turning the border zone into a battlefield under the pretext of a peaceful protest. And it says that anyone who tries to harm the border fence or harm soldiers is endangering him or herself. And is warning about tomorrow, saying that that is what is going to happen tomorrow. Now, the army spokesman spoke to reporters. He would not specify the army's rules of engagement, you know, when exactly it's going to shoot. It does, in terms of, you know, in which area, how close can you get up to the border fence? It said Israel has no problem in general with nonviolent demonstrations. The Palestinians, you know, when you go up to this area and you see families picnicking, not right up to the border where there are youth with slingshots and Israel says militants have approached the border. So there is there's a mixed group of people coming to these protests.
What is, we know that there was, Israeli officials spoke with reporters today. What did they say about how they want to stop the protests from continuing? Because these protests are supposed to go on until mid-May. Maybe you can tell us this. Significance of that date?
Right. Well, these protests started last Friday, which was Palestinian Land Day, and it was a day to mark lands lost to Israel. And Palestinians say that they are gathering at the border demanding for the right to return to lands that are in Israel today, and that this will last 6 weeks until mid-May. For the Palestinian, what's called the day, the Nakba day, the day of catastrophe, which marks the day that Israel, the time that Israel was founded 70 years ago. Israel says, the Israeli army says that that Hamas knows exactly the area next to the border that is it considers a hostile zone, and it warns Hamas and warns other people not to go near there.
The larger picture here, Daniel, is what? I mean, there's obviously long been violence between Gaza and Israel. What, if anything, is different about these events?
Well, this is the first time Palestinians are holding daily protests, this kind of sit-in, for such a long time every day at the border. You know, Hamas and Israel have fought three wars in the last decade, but this is something very different.
All right. Thank you. Daniel Estrin, NPR international correspondent, speaking to us from Gaza City. Thank you, Daniel.
You're welcome, Lisa.
In 2014 and 15, there was a cluster of suicides at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Six students and a professor took their lives within a little more than a year. After that, the school newspaper published a series of stories. They were written by a student and a professor about their struggles with depression. An MIT computer science professor, Daniel Jackson, noticed something about the reaction on campus. There was a wave of consoling and encouragement. Jackson is also a photographer, so he set out to document members of the community who had experienced depression and anxiety, and he asked them to tell their stories. He hung posters of the first few subjects around campus, and then so many people came forward, Jackson decided to compile a book. It's called Portraits of Resilience. Recently, I spoke with Jackson, as well as two of the people he profiled, MIT junior Emily Tang and Victor Morales, who graduated in 2014. I started by asking Professor Jackson if it surprised him that people volunteered to tell their stories.
It did, to be honest. I have to say that when I created the project in the beginning and had committed to publishing a photo and a story every week, I was a little nervous that it would dry up and that people wouldn't come, but I was not to be disappointed, and people came with extraordinary stories.
Victor Morales, you were one of the people who came, one of the students. Why did you show up, and what was your story?
When I saw those posters on the halls, not really knowing that I was going through depression yet, just seeing those posters, you know, their images printed out nicely all around campus, I felt inspired by their stories. And when I got in touch with Professor Jackson, I had the opportunity to share mine.
What is your story?
I remember my sophomore year at MIT, I failed two classes. And for the first time that I remember, I felt anxiety, this feeling, this urge to just crawl up into a ball and not do anything. And I felt powerless. And I felt alone. All these people admired me. They thought I was a straight-A student. They thought I was really good at math, when really I wasn't.
Emily Tang, you are part of the book. You've told your story. Tell us now.
I think as early as eighth grade, I started experiencing a lot of depression. That was the first time I really felt a lot of overwhelming pressure to do well in my studies.
That young?
Yeah, I think that was when I'd started taking my first high school level class that would start counting towards my GPA, because I was in an advanced math class. I started self-harming at that time. I would cut my arm with a razor.
Because why?
I alternated between emptiness and wanting to feel something and feeling like everything was my fault and wanting to punish myself.
So what happened when you got to MIT? I mean, really pressure-filled environment.
I failed a class my freshman fall. And I failed the class at the time actually because I didn't meet the attendance requirement. I hadn't been to lecture enough times. I think that was kind of when things started slipping through the cracks. Like, I started not showing up for things. I guess I didn't realize it was another onset of depression. I'd never really confronted my depression before that point.
What part of the difficulty is the fact that it's a very competitive school? You're expected to be a high achiever. The fact that it's MIT,
I think for me, a lot of it was academics had sort of formed one of the core pieces of my identity, right? Like I was, all I was, you know, the nerd, the encyclopedia, the machine, the calculator. Those are literally names I got called in high school. And I think people meant them in a fun, jokey kind of way, but they really made me feel ostracized and made me feel like I wasn't somebody that people saw as a person, but rather as, you know, just a product of my academics. And I think what has really helped since then has been finding other things to define myself, like letting myself enjoy my hobbies, thinking it doesn't matter that I'm not going to be a famous artist. Like if I enjoy drawing, it can take up a lot of my time. I can do music. I can do these things that don't necessarily contribute to my future because they're a core part of who I am. I'm a person who loves to read. I'm a person who enjoys baking and cooking. And those are good things. And those are things that make up me. And I can, you know, spend time on them.
For both Emily and you, Victor, and many of the people you profile in the book, Professor, community was a huge part of their recovery and the resilience. What do you think about that?
What amazed me was it wasn't just the closest friends who helped people, but it was the larger community as well. I was very struck by a comment that Lydia, one of my portrait people, as we've taken to calling them, made. She said that sometimes you don't know who the people are who are the glue who are holding your life together until they die. And she said, and sometimes you don't even realize that you're the glue holding other people's lives together.
Can you, Victor or Emily, give me one example of when somebody was there for you and you really felt as though it made a difference?
I remember going through the worst weeks of my depression. I couldn't get out of bed. I was sleeping 12 hours every night. I couldn't really eat. And I remember texting some of my friends, and they came and helped me get out of bed. They didn't present a judgment. They didn't ask me what's going on. They understood that I was going through a difficult period of my life. And they are a large part of the reason why I survived.
Daniel Jackson, this is a picture book, and it's a storybook. You have the stories of Victor and Emily and many other students as well, and faculty.
And administrators as well.
Administrators at MIT. I mean, it's a significant statement. But the images themselves, I wonder what your motivation was. It didn't seem to me that you were looking for pictures of very sad, depressed people. What were you doing?
Absolutely not. I guess the first thing I was trying to do was to allow these people who in some respects had been left unacknowledged and in the dark, to allow these people to show their faces and to say, you know, here I am, this is me. I hoped to show them in a way that was respectful to the fullness of their life and experience.
Yeah,
and
they don't look like people who one should pity.
That's right, because in their stories, although they all faced formidable challenges, they show such extraordinary qualities of character and mind, and they've accomplished so much. And I find a positive, happy ending in a way in every story. Even if they didn't find complete resolution, they came to terms with things, and they have a lot to teach us.
Daniel Jackson, Victor Morales, and Emily Tang, thank you all.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Professor Daniel Jackson's book is called Portraits of Resilience. You can see some of the photos at Here and Now. Our next story is about rescuing something that had been put out to pasture. It's an old tractor, a tractor some historians say may be America's most famous tractor because of its symbolic role in settling the American West. From NET News in Nebraska, Mike Tobias reports.
It's last summer, and a helicopter is lifting a 73-year-old tractor out of the Alaska mud. The nearest road is miles away. That explains the helicopter. But why go to all the trouble? This tractor's been abandoned in the wilderness for decades. It's too rusty and beat up to be functional. To understand this effort, we first have to tell the story of two former soldiers. The first is Union Army veteran Daniel Freeman, who in 1863 settled in southeastern Nebraska and built a log cabin. Spin forward a century, and in 1974, Ken Deardorff returned from fighting in Vietnam and moved to the Alaska wilderness. He also built a log cabin. Two young veterans looking for a new start. In Nebraska, Freeman was the first to file for the Homestead Act of 1862, which let any American claim up to 160 acres of free land. In Alaska, Deardorff was the last. He used that 1945 Aulis Chalmers Model C tractor to clear his land and cultivate crops. Battling fire, brutal weather, grizzly bears, sometimes even the tractor.
When Ken would be on this tractor pulling stumps, at times the tractor would rear up.
That's Mark Engler, superintendent of Homestead National Monument. This national park sits on the site of the first homestead near Beatrice, Nebraska. Its supporters gave $78,000 to rescue the tractor, abandoned since Deerdorf left his homestead in 1984.
Hey, there we go.
First, a team of six people had to pull the tractor from the mud where it sat for nearly three decades, then wrap it in a cargo net for that helicopter ride. Then it was transported nearly 4,000 miles on a ship, then a truck, to here, this metal shed at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. So students like sister and brother, Asha and Jathan Scheidler, could work on it for a few weeks.
I'm just trying to clean off like the black mold and wiping down all like the dirt and stuff that's on there.
Right now I'm just kind of vacuuming to get kind of all the debris and the dirt that's been built up on this tractor.
We're going to clean it up some. We're going to try and stabilize it. Part of conservation work, you try and slow any future deterioration.
Al Levitan spent years working on restoration projects for the National Park Service. After helping get the tractor out of Alaska, he came here to show students how to preserve it.
We don't want to restore it to an as-new appearance. We want it to look as closely as it possibly could as to when Ken actually used it.
Restored to its middle-aged Alaskan glory, with worn orange paint and a beat-up wooden box for a seat, this old tractor is on display at Homestead National Monument. It reminds us of the more than 1 million homesteaders who endured hardships in return for free land and a new start in life. For NPR News, I'm Mike Tobias in Lincoln, Nebraska.
A Massachusetts war hero is now in his final resting place. Thomas Hudner, who received the Medal of Honor in 1951 for bravery during the Korean War, was buried at Arlington National Cemetery. Here now's Alex Ashlock was at Arlington yesterday and has this report.
Friends and family gathered in Section 54 on a gray and blustery afternoon. They watched as Thomas Hudner was buried with full military honors. The U.S. Navy band played as a horse-drawn caisson carried Hudner's casket to the gravesite. His place in American military history was evident in the people who gathered to pay their respects. Joseph Dunford, a Boston native, Marine general, and now chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, was there. A dozen other Medal of Honor recipients. And Francisco Llerena, a former Marine who's now State Secretary of Veterans Services, a job Tom Hudner used to hold.
Today, what we all witnessed was a sense of a life well lived, and it was nothing short of what Tom deserved.
Young pilots, members of Hudner's former squadron, soared overhead in F-18s. They flew in the missing man formation, appropriate because this isn't just Tom Hudner's story.
I think it's just great closure, being able to see the sort of ceremonial burial that Jesse Brown never got to have.
That's Jessica Knight Henry. Her grandfather was Ensign Jesse Brown. Brown was the son of Mississippi sharecroppers. He overcame racism to become the Navy's first black pilot. And it was Jesse Brown that Tom Hudner, a white man from Fall River, Massachusetts, tried to save on a frozen hillside in Korea in 1950. The act that earned him the Medal of Honor. Tom Hudner III is one of his sons.
On that day, December 4th, 1950, he said he was doing his job, and he was helping out a squadron mate who needed help. So in his mind, it wasn't an extraordinary act. It was just the right thing to do.
Hudner crash-landed his own plane to try to save Brown, who had been shot down. Brown was trapped, and Hudner tried for 45 minutes to free him. It was freezing cold and getting dark, and the helicopter that had landed to rescue both men couldn't fly at night. So Hudner had to make an agonizing decision to leave to save his own life.
You know, I think he probably felt some responsibility to, you know, help carry on Jesse's legacy. I mean, Jesse's legacy and Jesse in his own right, I mean, his own story is just incredible. And what he achieved and the adversity that he overcame is incredible.
Jesse Brown's remains were never recovered. But Brown's granddaughter, Jessica Knight Henry, says his loss forged a friendship that outlives both men.
You know, they were tied together in that selfless act that Tom made. But I think it's reflective in the relationship that we still have with the Hudner family. And so the stories of these two men live on long after they both have sort of passed here.
Jesse Brown was 24 when he died. Thomas Hudner was 93. For Here and Now, I'm Alex Ashley.
Mexico's presidential campaign season formally opened on Sunday, and one of the issues candidates are grappling with is a surge in drug cartel violence. There were more than 29,000 murders last year in Mexico. It's the most since the government started taking comparable records back in 1997. For more, we're joined by Alfredo Corchado. He's an author and correspondent for the Dallas Morning News. And Alfredo, put this into context for us. It sounds like drug violence is as bad as it's ever been.
It's bad as it's ever been. It's the worst violence that we've seen that's been recorded, as you said, 97. But when you talk to experts, they say it's the worst violence in a century in Mexico. And the first 3 months of this year, the numbers are already up compared to last year. So it's a pretty bloody time here.
What's going on?
You know, it's a big question, and there's many factors. I guess the big factor is the power vacuum that was left after Joaquin El Chapo Guzman was extradited to the U.S. You've had many other cartels that are fighting for distribution routes, chiefly the cartel from Jalisco. They're younger, they're bloodier, and they've been all over the country. I mean, whether it's the southern part of Mexico, the Cancun area, to the northern part, Tijuana, the Chihuahua. I mean, they've been all over the country.
Well, you mentioned Cancun. Now, I know that a lot of people are very concerned about some of the violence that is spreading to tourist area. In January, there was a deadly nightclub shooting at the beach destination of Playa del Carmen. There was an explosion that took down a ferry in February in that area. Are we seeing a new strategy by the cartels to target these areas, or are they just sort of caught in the crossfire?
They're caught in the crossfire from the experts that we've talked to. I was also in Cabo San Lucas, another very popular destination for Americans. They're putting in millions of dollars in to try to, you know, tell Americans, hey, it's safe, or just foreigners in general. But one of the interesting things there was that you've had corpses, you know, from bridges, something you've never seen before in some of these touristy areas. You had a shootout on the beach. It's a really, really difficult time because when tourism has always been the sure money making business in Mexico, and when that is in trouble, then it's a sign that the rest of the country is in trouble.
Yeah, you mentioned El Chapo, the Sinaloa drug cartel leader, who escaped from custody several times but is now sitting in jail awaiting trial in New York. Is there someone who's coming up behind him, a similar charismatic leader?
Not at all. And that's been the big concern, is that Chapo Guzman has generally, traditionally favored profits over headlines. And these new cartels, they're young, upstart, hyperviolent members who are really have power in mind. You don't have that strong man who could make deals behind the scenes, etc. And that's something that, at least when we talk to American officials, I mean, that's something that does concern them. The other thing that's a big, big deal, Peter, is that with the growing legalization of marijuana in the U.S., cartels are now pushing meth and heroin, and that's a new business. That's something that I think has jump-started a lot of mm-hmm. businesses or a lot of these cartel organizations.
This violence started really escalating back in 2006 when former President Felipe Calderon launched Mexico's war on the cartels. He sent thousands of troops into his home state of Michoacan. He said at the time that his strategy was to cut the head off of the snake. Now, we've come a long way since then, but politically speaking, it sounds like we're almost in the exact same spot.
Same spot and same strategy. And when you talk to experts, you know, one person I talked to recently said this is like the armchair definition of insanity. I mean, more military forces on the streets only breeds more violence, and that's exactly what we've been seeing.
But I remember in 2012 when Enrique Peña Nieto was running for president in Mexico, he promised that he was going to do something different than Felipe Calderón, that he was going to have a completely different strategy. What happened over the last 6 years?
Well, it started off that way. I mean, you saw the Mexican government under Peña Nieto sort of move away from the U.S. strategy, from the Mérida plan.
And the Mérida plan was the money that the United States sent into Mexico to help with this problem.
Right, the foreign assistance from the U.S. But then the violence just really took off, and the government had no choice but to bring back the military into the streets of Mexico. And you're seeing almost a replica. I mean, yes, it's been Felipe Calderón 2006, and some estimates have the numbers at more than 230,000 people killed since.
Wow.
So you're repeating the same mistakes from the past. I mean, it's been a no-win situation for civil society.
Is it as big of an issue this time around as this next campaign season gets started?
That's certainly what the candidates are saying, and certainly every poll that we've seen shows that it's violence, corruption, security are the dominating issues that voters are concerned about.
Well, let's talk about what those candidates are saying. You have leftist Andrés Manuel López Obrador. He's run before. We know his name. He's got this populist economic message, and he's promised to end the war against drug cartels in 3 years, in part by offering amnesty to the cartels. How would that work?
And that's not a new idea in Latin America. I mean, countries like El Salvador have done that. It's not something that really has so well throughout Mexico. I mean, there's a lot of debate about that. He said, look, we will shorten the prison terms. He will have referendums on many of these issues, whether it's violence or whether it's his own presidency. We'll have a plebiscite every 2 years to see, you know, how people feel about this, feel about that. I think it's safe to say that he's lacked the details to really give voters an idea what exactly he will do differently from other administrations.
Obrador is the front runner, according to the polls at this point. What are the others saying?
The others, we have Ricardo Anaya, in most polls, he comes off in second place. He's a member of the PAN, the National Action Party, a conservative party, who's built an alliance with the left-leaning PRD party. He has said basically that he plans to keep the military, the Marines, out on the streets. But also he wants to focus a lot more on strengthening the Attorney General's office and having an independent Attorney General's office to go after in impunity. Jose Antonio Meade, who's a candidate for the ruling party, and Margarita Zavala, who's running as the first independent candidate, have both, their plans are almost identical. Keep the military on the streets, and very much like Enrique Peña Nieto, the current president.
Alfredo, I'm just wondering what the everyday Mexican citizen must be thinking as they hear these candidates give out these ideas, many of which they've heard before. You know, the problem's been going on for a long time. No one's been able to solve it. Is there any hope that anything is going to change?
You know, Peter, I've been covering elections in Mexico for well over 20 years, and I can tell you that this is the first time where I don't see the kind of fear that I used to see before. I mean, I think most elections that I've covered have always been based on the fear that's out there. There is downright anger today that you're hearing the same things, that no one's really talking specifics about these issues. And that the violence has gotten worse. No one can really remember a time when there was so much corruption. Here we are 30 years after NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement. Life was supposed to get better. Distribution of wealth was supposed to be better. And virtually wages remain the same. So there is a lot of anger out in the streets. And I think all of this sort of bodes well for the front runner, López Obrador. I mean, there were three big debates that are coming. I think that's when the election will be decided. But I think most people have sort of made up their mind that, you know, this guy, his austerity, He lives a pretty simple life. If he keeps doing what he's doing for the next 80-something days, you're likely to see the next president of Mexico.
Hmm. Before I let you go, tell me a little bit about the people who are falling victim to this violence. And we can talk about politics all day, but there are actual 29,000 people died last year.
That's right, 29,000 people. And again, you know, it's a figure that we don't really talk about that much, but more than 200,000 people have died in general. I mean, many of them, majority of them, people under 30, many of them innocent people, people who had nothing to do with the drug trade, people just caught in the crossfire. It's left many, many communities, not just anger, but I mean, there's a real sense of sadness. I think for many of them, it's anger and also, you know, the elusive search for justice that's keeping them afloat.
That's Alfredo Corchado, correspondent for the Dallas Morning News and author of the book Midnight in Mexico. Alfredo, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you very much, Peter.
Thanks to Twitter, it's not hard to figure out what's on President Trump's mind. He likes the idea of a border wall. He likes actress Roseanne Barr and presidential physician Ronny Jackson. In the dislike column, there's DACA, Hillary Clinton, and now topping that list, The Washington Post and, by extension, the Post's owner, Amazon founder Jeff Bezos. Here's a presidential tweet from 9:15 this morning. Quote, "The fake news Washington Post Amazon chief lobbyist has another of many phony headlines, Trump defiant as China adds trade penalties. Wrong," it continues, "should read, Trump defiant as U.S. adds trade penalties will end barriers and massive IP theft, typically bad reporting," end tweet. Joining us to sort out that rather long tweet and what's behind it is NPR's media correspondent David Folkenflecht. Hi, David.
Hey there, Lisa.
So what's at the root of Trump's rancor at both the Washington Post and Amazon's Jeff Bezos?
Well, I don't think this is a great mystery about this. I think if you look back to the president's candidacy, particularly in spring of 2016, you saw the Post do some real accountability journalism, where it started to look at the extent to which the president kept his promises, particularly to charities. And it was embarrassing and more embarrassing and humiliating. And he really started being upset about that. I think that the Post has really emerged to take a leading role in trying to provide accountability on this president and this administration. And I think that the president explicitly in his tweets and in his public comments on the stump, but you know, around the country, when he talks about this, he links Amazon to and Jeff Bezos, and Bezos, who personally owns the Washington Post. He bought it for, I believe it was $250 million. That's pocket change for Bezos. It is not part of the Amazon Corporation. But he links them together. And so he's taking aim at Amazon, about which we can – and we can talk about this later – about which there are real reasons to think hard about and to scrutinize and to question. But he's taking aim at Amazon because of his direct peek about the Washington Post. It's hard to separate the two.
So Martin Baron, who is the Post executive editor, has said that nobody at the newspaper is paid by Amazon and that the Post owner, Jeff Bezos, has done nothing, has no editorial decision-making power, despite what the president says. Is there any truth, David, to President Trump's allegations?
You know, in a less feverish moment, I think it's worth pointing out that it's perfectly valid to look at the Washington Post's coverage of Amazon, of its retail sales, of its effect on competitors, of its practices towards employees, of its contracts with the federal government for cloud services, and to see how the Post is handling it. I think, by and large, it's doing a pretty good job. I think it's doing a capable a look at those things. It is not fair to say that it is a lobbyist for Amazon. I think the Washington Post is performing a journalistic function. But I don't think Trump has any evidence to show that its coverage or its editorials even are carrying the water of Amazon in an untoward or indefensible way. I just don't think that case is there.
Are there firewalls between the editorial side of a newspaper like the Washington Post and the business side?
Yes, there are explicit codes at places like the Washington Post that say that, you know, journalistic decisions cannot be made for business reasons other than figuring out ways to appeal to the readers. They have to be truthful. They have to be fair. They have to be textured. They have to be complete. You can't omit facts, not only a question of what you present, but what you don't. And I also think there's a protection in the traditions of the Washington Post and in the men and women who make up that newsroom. I think they would be coming to me and to reporters at other news outlets in a heartbeat if they thought that somebody would be leaning on them. I also think it's worth pointing out that Marty Baron was the editor-in-chief of the Boston Globe at a time that the Globe really dug deep into the scandals involving the Catholic Church in Boston and later, you know, globally. And the Catholic Church itself put heavy pressure on the Boston Globe, which has a high Catholic readership up there in Boston and in New England. And, you know, he doesn't yield to pressure. Marty Baron, I think, is the preeminent newspaper editor in the country right now. And I don't think there's any sign of him having pressure there.
President Trump tweeted earlier on, not just today, but earlier in the week about Amazon, saying, quote, "Unlike others, they pay little or no taxes to state and local governments, use our postal system as their delivery boy, causing tremendous loss to the U.S. and putting thousands of retailers out of business." Truth squad that, David. Is the U.S. Postal Service losing money to Amazon?
No, Amazon is actually in the netting billions of dollars to the benefit of the Postal Service. It is in effectively subsidizing a lot of deliveries, particularly on weekends, that wouldn't otherwise happen by other people, by keeping routes profitable. Let me make one personal disclosure. It's worth pointing out that my wife is an employee of an Amazon subsidiary called Audible, which does, you know, audiobooks and other kinds of things that are equivalent to podcasts that she works on. But, you know, this is a company that actually most of what Trump has said about is not true. Certainly, I think it's fair to look at them in terms of antitrust. Trust, the size of the market they now control, the ways in which they've affected other companies. But states have taken action. Amazon is now paying much more than it used to in certain kinds of state taxes. And I think a lot of what the president's attacks are based on is his peek at the Post, as there hasn't been a lot of substance there in what he's offered so far.
Thanks a lot, David.
You bet.
David Folkenflik, NPR's media correspondent. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.